Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. There are thousands of you who listen to this program every week. Surely a bunch of you want to hear more than just the hour you hear each week. And I don't blame you. There's two more hours that you're missing with some great interviews and more analysis of this week's news with Digby. So check it out. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Sign up to become a member of the podcast. We're talking a couple of bucks a week. You will be supporting this show, making our free show possible, but you'll also be getting three times the amount of content. Three times one is three. There you go. So check it out, ROFpodcast.com. Thanks so much. Appreciate your listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, Laura Putnam from the University of Pittsburgh will explain how Middle America is rebooting democracy. SCOTUS expert Ian Melheiser will join us to discuss the case Janice v. AFSCME and why it has the potential to destroy public sector unions. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to break down this week's biggest news stories, and we'll talk to Thomas McGarity from the American Prospect about the Trump administration's use of an obscure Gingrich-era law that eviscerates health, safety, labor, environmental, and financial protections. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com, sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast, and if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze the biggest news stories of the past week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So Digby, obviously a lot of news this week, ranging from the intrigue that is taking place in the White House, as well as the implications of the tax cuts, what is happening at the Supreme Court, and we will be talking to Ian Melheiser later in the program about both the Janus case and how it will impact public sector unions, and the Rodriguez case and how it will impact the indefinite detention of immigrants, as well as there was a ruling that affected Dreamers. And of course, a lot of stuff happening with the Mueller investigation and Russia. But let's start with what is happening in the wake of the horrible massacre that took place in Parkland, Florida. Where would you place us in? I mean, in many respects, and I think you and I probably over the years have had countless conversations in the wake of these mass shooting events. And this one has been different. It remains to be seen if the outcomes are going to be different, but this one has been different. Where are we in the sort of the life cycle, if you will, of this horrible massacre?
Well, it's interesting. I think probably like you, when it first happened, I probably adopted a somewhat cynical posture, assuming that it would be the same, you know, sort of ritualistic process that we go through when we have these mass shootings. And you know, the truth is we've had a bunch just in the last year, you know, a horrific one in Las Vegas, one in the church down in Texas. And so, you know, I wasn't quite sure whether or not this one would be different, although a lot of people that I know were kind of sensing that from the very beginning, and I actually did not. But I have come around, and I believe that there is something different about this. Some of it just simply has to do with the fact that the kids that were, you know, the survivors of the assault, took a strong and blatant, open anti-gun posture, and that's not something that we see every day, right? And in fact, in recent days, I think there's been some reporting that after Las Vegas, that the members of the Democratic Party told people, you know, downplay it, don't go too far with the gun control thing, let's just all keep quiet, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the kids didn't get that memo. And as a result, they've been saying things that people are, you know, I mean, people like you and I say it, right? I mean, we say, you know, all that stuff. But I mean, to go on TV and to be so just sort of openly what I think people think maybe is naive turns out to be very powerful. And of course, this is happening within the context of the resistance in general,
right,
which I think is also part of this, where there, you know, I mean, from the Me Too movement to this, to all the electoral work that's going on in grassroots, there is a strong sense of just, you know, aggressive resistance to whatever the Republicans, Trump, and the conservative movement are doing at the moment. So I think that adds to it as well. But yeah, there is something different, and I still have tremendous doubts that it's going to lead to any kind of national fix for this problem, because the NRA is still tremendously powerful with a group that has veto power over anything that's done on guns, and that would be the Republican Party, and they've been lunching with Trump, who is basically, you know, their biggest fan, and they love him as well. So I don't see that there being a big national change, but this could definitely be an issue that actually has some intensity in the upcoming elections and could affect people on the state level. And bigger than that, I think it may have, and this would be just great if this happens, it may have stymied the NRA's big push for national concealed carry, which is hugely important.
Right.
And if it stops that, even if it temporarily, that is a huge, huge victory.
You're referring to the reciprocity bill, right? That is,
yes,
where if there is if someone has a concealed carry in a license in one state, they can then cross state lines at will, essentially, and have no concern about it, which effectively creates a national policy of concealed carry, regardless of where you are.
Right. And it's extremely dangerous in places like California, New York. I mean, any of the big urban centers, they're absolutely appalled at this idea. They have different set of problems than the people who want to run around with their pickup trucks in some rural area and carrying a gun, which most people in the big cities don't care. You know,
right,
if you want to do that, fine. But we have a lot of people concentrated in one place, and having people with guns, you know, legally carrying guns is not a great idea. I mean, here in California,
let's be honest. I mean, the statistically speaking, the need for a gun in the city is pretty low. I mean,
yeah,
I guess maybe if you're a drug dealer or if you are someone who has reason to believe you're going to be attacked by random people, because maybe you're a public figure, or maybe you're some type of kidnapping candidate. Although maybe we don't hear about kidnappings the way that we used to. But the fact of the matter is that in these cities, they are as safe as they've been, certainly since probably either one of us have been alive, quite
exactly,
frankly. And you know, it's not like you're going to see that rabid raccoon, the charging bear that you might see in a rural area, and so the actual need for this gun is pretty low in these urban environments.
Well, you know, it's funny because I remember in California, up until recently, there was a period here where there was a law that you could openly carry a gun as long as it wasn't loaded, right? And what would happen is cops would routinely stop people who were carrying and say, you know, show me, you know, prove to me that this gun isn't loaded. So what was happening, though, and I observed this a number of times, people were walking around with these big guns strapped to their legs or, an AR-15, you know, hanging off their backs, and they'd be going into these public places. And I'm telling you, it was a tremendously unpleasant, creepy kind of environment. It would scare me. It scared a lot of people. You'd sit there and you had to, you know, look out of the corner of your eye. What's going on here? It didn't seem safe. They'd sort of throw the guns around. You know, there was it was a really, really bad idea. I think the idea was to normalize the idea, normalize
right.
the fact that people were, that it was okay if everybody was carrying guns, you'd get used to seeing it. Well, you didn't. And you'd see people in places. I remember standing in Starbucks, which right by my house, with this whole group of young guys. They were doing one of their little protests, right, you know, where they go into Starbucks and hang around and show off their guns. And a bunch of cops came in, and I'm telling you, the room was electric. It was really unpleasant. Now, the idea being, of course, that this one group was unarmed. The cops presumably were, their guns were loaded. But nonetheless, this is not, I don't want to live in a place like that. I just don't. I don't want to live in a place where there are people with lethal weapons just wandering around in, you know, in my grocery store. It's just, it's unnecessary. It's dangerous. It's a lethal thing. And I think, and California ended up repealing that law.
Wow.
You can't walk around with a gun loaded or unloaded anymore. So, and I would hope that it would remain that way. I know that the cops did not like it. It was a very, very unpleasant situation for them. And by the way, that leads to a lot of this unnecessary police violence as well.
Indeed.
The idea that they,
Heather,
guns everywhere.
Yeah, let's hold that thought for one moment. When we come back, let's talk about that and talk about, at the very least, what we're seeing in terms of the corporate blowback against the NRA.
Right.
And the tying in the manufacturers of these guns to what they end up doing. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm Sam Seder. I'm here with the great Heather Parton, or Digby. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So Digby, in the last segment, we were talking about where we are in this sort of, I guess the cycle that follows these mass shooting events. And in this case, 17 people killed, murdered by a young, I don't know, I wouldn't say a kid, but a young adult who was had access to military grade or style weapons and tore through a high school. And, you know, one of the things that I feel like, and we mentioned some of the things that are a little bit different, of course, the victims being high school students, both were very outspoken and very difficult to attack. I mean, I saw an Eric Erickson headline article claiming that these students were bullies because they were bullying the NRA. They were bullying gun rights advocates. And because they're victims, that we can't push back on them or something. You know, some aggrievement that how dare these victims of this horrible massacre have an opinion on weapons. I mean, it really is, it was fascinating to watch that. But I also was struck by two developments. One is that there was a real, there was a substantial, it wasn't huge, but a substantial amount of time dedicated to the American Outdoor Company, formerly Smith & Wesson, and its CEO, because let's face it, this company makes a product that had the ability to rip through the flesh of 17 people, I think of us, 14 of whom were teenagers, and they should own that. They should own that their product does this. I mean, and there's some people who say, well, you know, cars kill people too, but we have cars. But there is a very important social need for cars. That's just the reality. I mean, maybe it would be better for the environment if we could replace that with public transport. Of course, you know, buses hit people too. Trains, people die. But the fact is, we have a serious societal need for transportation. There is no societal need or benefit from the production of AR-15s. There simply isn't. I mean, no one can point to a time during the assault weapon ban where we had some type of like drop off in the functioning of society. And yet these guys make a machine essentially that tears through children, toddlers, one or two a week die from getting hands on a gun. And I, for one, am very happy to see the people who are enriching themselves be forced to own how they make their money.
Absolutely. I mean, look at it this way. And people make this sort of analogy all the time, and I think it's really worth thinking about. If there were a drug that was killing 35,000 people a year, but it also was helping a whole bunch of people, they would outlaw the drug. And the reason is the liability for the drug companies would be so overwhelming that they would have to do that. And it has happened in the past. There have been drugs that do help people within, you know, for certain illnesses, but the side effects of death among a substantial number have forced the drug companies to stop producing them. Now, I would say that there is better reason for those drugs to be on the market because at least they were helping people on some level. Whereas guns, I mean, to my way of thinking, I see no purpose for humans to have, especially these you know, semi-automatic weapons. But even if you just sort of say, okay, they have a right to have them, you know, it's in the Constitution, or you know, they're just it's fun for them or whatever. These manufacturers of guns who are making these lethal weapons, I do not understand how it can possibly be that they don't suffer the same liability that every other manufacturer of you know, products that kill people have to face.
I can tell you why, because there's a federal statute that that gives them special immunity to this type of liability. And you know, this is one of those things where, you know, where people can hold Democrats to account and get them to, when they're in a position to do so, to repeal this law, and then they just hand it over to folks like my friend, like Mike Papantonio, who will make these companies suffer, at the very least, economically, to the point where they may not be able to produce guns that have things like an absence of like a fingerprint lock or something like that. I mean, there are a lot of things that could make it easier and safer. They're not going to take care of every situation. No solution is going to deal with every situation. But the idea that we wouldn't even take a sliver of a chance that we could have less death from these death machines is ridiculous. Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, we've got a lot more to talk about. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, we will talk to Supreme Court of the United States expert Ian Millhiser about some interesting cases in front of the highest court in the land. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
Can you even see what you're fighting for? Bloodlust and a holy war. Listen up, hear the patriots shout. Times are changing.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. This week, the Supreme Court of the United States heard oral arguments in the case Janus v. AFSCME. This case has the potential to destroy public sector unions once and for all. Here to discuss, Ian Millhiser from Think Progress. So, Ian, undoubtedly, we spoke, I don't know, sometime over the past couple of years, maybe multiple times over the past couple of years, about a case that is no longer relevant called Friedrichs. And this was a case which involved I believe it was a California teacher who was claiming that she didn't want to pay her agency fees. These are the fees that are paid to a union when you don't want to join and you don't want to pay for their political activity, but you've got to pay for them to represent you because the law says that the union has to represent you, and so they deserve to be paid for their work. She was saying this was an infringement upon her rights. And it looked like public sector unions were in big trouble. And then, for those people who believe in a higher power, and Scalia exited his bodily form on this planet and saved public sector unions, in among other things. But we have a new case, and this is Janus v. AFSCME. There were oral arguments this week. I know that you were following them quite closely. Tell us about Janus. And tell us what's going on with these oral arguments, and what are the implications of this case?
So the issue here that, like you said, if you work in a unionized shop, the union has to represent all of the workers in the unionized workplace, regardless of whether those workers choose to join the union or not. And there's a ton of benefits to working in a unionized shop. On average, unionized workers make about 12% more. So typically what happens is that unions will try to bargain for an agreement that says that if you don't want to join the union, you don't have to join the union. You actually have a constitutional right not to join the union. But you do have to reimburse the union for the fair share of the bargaining and the grievance management and all of the benefits that it provides to the non-members. And that's what these agency fees are. What this Janus case is trying to do, what the Friedrichs case tried to do 2 years ago, is say that for public sector unions, these agency fees are unconstitutional. And it's a rather, I think, rather silly and rather aggressive theory of the First Amendment they're using to get there. And now that Republicans have their majority back on the Supreme Court, it looks all but certain that the unions are going to lose this case.
Let's talk about that that theory around the First Amendment. If I understand it correctly, the argument is because these are public sector unions and they are negotiating with a government entity, maybe it's a county, maybe it's a city, maybe it's a town, maybe it's a state, that they are going to, whatever amount of money they get is going to come out of tax dollars, and therefore it is a sort of a political act that they're doing. And if I'm a member of a union and I don't think government should spend much money, then the union in negotiating my contract is actually forcing me to adopt a political position that I don't want. Is that the argument? Because it sounds bizarre.
Well, so basically what the plaintiffs are trying to do in this case is they're trying to blur the line between the way that the Constitution treats, or the way the government's allowed to treat its employees and the way that the government's allowed to treat the general public. So, like, if the government came to you and said, Sam, I am ordering you to teach a lesson on To Kill a Mockingbird, that's not something that the government can allow you to, can force you to do. The government can't force you to speak against your will. But I was once an English teacher, and I worked for the government when I was an English teacher. And the government had every right to order me to teach To Kill a lesson on To Kill a Mockingbird, because that was my job. You know, the First Amendment has a lot of things to say about what the government general public, it has many fewer things to say about what the government's allowed to do to its employees. The government can fire government employees potentially if they say something in certain context that goes against the message that the government is trying to convey. So that's just the way that things work. It's like the Supreme Court has always recognized that the government has employees. It needs to be able to manage the workplace just like any other workplace. And so the First Amendment just functions differently in the workplace context than when it does when the government is regulating people as individuals.
Because you can't have the government have less ability as an employer than people in the private sector have as employers.
Right. So the theory here is that if the government were to force someone to advocate on behalf of whatever union wants to advocate for, that would be illegal. And so in theory, it is also illegal for the government to make someone contribute money to the union. There's actually a lot of problems with that legal theory as well. It taxes people, and it spends at least some of those taxes on things, on communicating messages that you and I might not agree with. You know, in the 1980s, you had the Just Say No campaign. Maybe you or I don't agree with the message conveyed by the Just Say No campaign. Tough. We still had to pay our taxes.
For instance, the government forces me, the state government forces me to get car insurance. And I have little doubt that these insurance companies who I'm forced to pay aren't advocating for things from our government that I disagree with.
Right. Yeah, and that, you know, that's just another example, right? So the government can say to you, you must buy car insurance, and the car insurance company is then allowed to take the money it collects from you and lobby. Not only is it allowed to take the money it collects from you and lobby the state, it's allowed to take that money and lobby the state to pass a law to force you to buy more insurance.
Right.
So, like, you know, this theory that they're arguing in Janus doesn't really make much sense if you think about its implications for other cases. And at the oral argument, what you heard from the liberal justices was a certain exasperation with this. They kept giving examples about, well, what about this case where, you know, people could have to contribute money? What about bar associations where you can't practice law unless you contribute to a bar association? What about student activities fees where if you're a student at a public university, you may have to pay into a general fund and then that fund may bring in a speaker you disagree with? So this is something that happens all the time. And what the impression I got from the Republican justices, at least the three that actually spoke, is that they didn't really want to engage with those problems. They just want to create a, you know, good for union tool. They don't like unions. They're going to create a rule that will be bad for unions here. And then they'll just come up with some excuse to distinguish the other cases.
I mean, that is, and I know, and we've spoken many times in the past about the Supreme Court, but that is an incredibly cynical perspective, one that I think is also probably dead on. Like they're going to fashion a principle that is going to be narrowly tailored to just people they don't like, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Bush v. Gore of First Amendment. You know, like Bush v. Gore, right. You'll remember, is five justices decided to elect George W. Bush. So they wrote an opinion that explicitly that, you know, this legal reasoning is good for this ride only. And what's funny about the legal reasoning in Bush v. Gore is, you know, in that case, it led to George W. Bush being elected. But a lot of it was actually really progressive and would have led to progressive outcomes in a lot of election cases. And nope, you're not allowed to use it for those cases. You're only allowed to use it to elect George W. Bush. It's the same kind of case here.
Are they going to, well, when we come back, let's take a break. When they come back, I want to know, is this going to spur other lawsuits to sort of test that theory as to whether or not, you know, we can get out of paying for stuff if that stuff is going to be used to support public, you know, speech that we don't like, particularly when it's the government forcing us to pay for this stuff. And also, I'm curious as to what's going to happen with appellate judges and judges on the federal judiciary who are not at the Supreme Court. Are we going to see how are they going to react to that? And then We're also going to discuss this ruling that took place in the Supreme Court in the Rodriguez case, which I find just absolutely stunning, and it has to do with indefinite detention. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Pap has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to Ian Millhiser about the second of two very important Supreme Court cases this week. The second one, of course, is Rodriguez. So, Ian, at the break, we were talking about the Janice v. AFSCME case. This is a case that union people and public sector union watchers have been dreading. They dreaded it when it showed up in the form of the Friedrichs case 2 years ago. This is a case that could and will most likely, based upon what we heard from the Republican judges in this oral arguments this week, it will strip public sector unions of funds from those people who don't want to pay them to represent them. Now, it is the case, Ian, right, that in we're talking about 22 states here, that in many of those blue states, the state and maybe the municipalities will figure out a way of still providing the union with money to represent the union in these negotiations. Because we got to remind people that if you're an employer, you would much rather negotiate with a single entity than literally thousands of people right. on a person-by-person basis, right? Because it's just not efficient. What do you mean?
You could have multiple unions.
And that's what happens in Europe, in fact. Yeah. Maybe we'll see that in the future. It seems like what stuns me is if collective bargaining ends up being a political act, then it starts to implicate things like how do you outlaw collective bargaining in Wisconsin, or how do you right. keep collective bargaining entities from engaging in wildcat strikes? I mean, what is the limiting principle here?
Yeah, I mean, the problem here is that there isn't really a limiting principle in either direction. So, on the one hand, if collective bargaining is itself a form of First Amendment protected speech, that means you can't have laws limiting the kind of bargaining that can go on. On the other hand, first of all, there isn't really a principled – I mean, some of the justices were feeling around for one, but there isn't really a principled legal distinction under the First Amendment between collective bargaining and individual bargaining. Justice Scalia, of all people, made this point a few years ago. So, if the government – if employment bargaining is a First Amendment protected activity, then it's not entirely clear that a government employer can say to one of their employees, hey, I don't want to talk to you right now, or I don't want to hear about this grievance you have until later, because that would be government censorship, and that's not allowed.
Fascinating. All right. Well, let's we anticipate this is a case that we're going to hear about in June, and that we're going to see a lot of other cases and lawsuits that are going to be based upon this theory that may come out of this case, depending on how the justices twist and turn in trying to limit their finding to just this case. But let's turn our attention for a moment to this other case that was adjudicated by SCOTUS this week, and that is the Rodriguez case. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is really troubling. So this case involves various kinds of immigrants who were detained for different reasons. So some of them are people who are apprehended at the border. Some of them are people who are lawful permanent residents and were accused of a crime, in some cases some very minor crimes, and were detained for that reason. And the law allows the government to detain these individuals basically while their immigration proceeding is pending. So while the proceeding is pending to determine whether or not this person is going to be deported, the government's allowed to detain them. And in some cases, that detention can take a really long time. The average length is over 400 days. There was one individual who was detained for over 1,500 days. So these are people, you know, they're just waiting, you know, and many of them wind up winning their cases. About a third of them wind up being told at the end of all that detention, oh, we were wrong. You get to stay in the country anyway.
Right.
So it's a messy system where people are getting detained. A lot of them are getting detained for no good reason. As it turns out, the government was wrong in the end.
And how do we justify this? I mean, how do we justify detaining people?
Well, so this case is about how we can justify it. So what the immigrants were asking for in this case is they just wanted, look, every 60 days, give us a hearing. You know, let us, like, every 60 days check in, make sure that detention is still necessary, make sure it's still legal, make sure that there's that you actually need to keep us and that you actually have a real justification for it. And you can't just, you know, in the same way that you would do for an accused criminal who's out on bail, you let them live their lives until their trial. You know, treat us the way you would treat a criminal and let us you know, have some sort of a bond hearing. And the Ninth Circuit had said, yes, you should. We will do you the service of treating you like a criminal.
Right.
And the Supreme Court, they didn't say no. What the Supreme Court said was they said, well, the Ninth Circuit didn't do it right. But then the disturbing part of the opinion is that at the end, Justice Alito said in the majority, oh, and by the way, I don't think you're allowed to bring this question as a class action, which potentially means that every single individual immigrant is going to have to adjudicate whether they have a right to a hearing.
Jeez.
And then they potentially then have to go to the hearing after that. You know, instead of being able to do this in one grand litigation that establishes that everyone has certain rights, and then those rights are protected throughout. It's going to be done in piecemeal litigation. A lot of these immigrants aren't going to be able to get lawyers. They aren't going to be able to afford lawyers. Even if they do get lawyers, it can take 3, 4, 5 months to adjudicate the question of whether or not they're entitled to a hearing. And meanwhile, you know, they're all sitting in detention. So, you know, basically what this case is about is whether the government is allowed to twiddle its thumbs trying to figure out what it's going to do and whether or not it's going to honor these individuals' constitutional rights. And in the meantime, they get to sit in a detention facility.
It's absolutely we're through the looking glass when there are just human beings in our country who are asking to be treated as well as people as criminals under our Constitution. It's just, it's nuts. And unfortunately, Ian, we're out of time, but just in about 10, 15 seconds, is there a chance that any of this is going to be revisited, or are we there now?
Well, so it'll go back to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit will probably rule that there's a constitutional violation here. But if they can't do it as a class action, so a class action means that you get one decision that says, yep, all of these immigrants that this applies to, they all right. have this right. If you can't do it as a class action, it means that each individual immigrant potentially is going to have to litigate their case on their own. And again, like,
so this is going to be one of those situations where it's like a de facto loss of those rights, because in practical terms, it's going to be much harder for people to get treated even like a criminal in our justice system. Ian Millhiser, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ian Millhiser is the justice editor for Think Progress and author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join me to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show and hear what you're missing.
Go your way. I'll take the long way round. Oh, I'll find my own way down. Oh, as I should.